Scout pointed out particular areas in the cityscape. That is Letifora, directly in front of us. There are some humans there, a few of my own kin, but mostly Ubariu and a handful of Akronta. All in all, I'd say there are about 200,000. His hand was raised toward the west where, close to the horizon, they could see another city. That one is the largest city this side of the ocean. It's called Hofica, and it offers shelter to 10 times 100,000. He turned to the east. Over there is the region of the monsters. They've taken over the ruins of old settlements where humans used to live. They were abandoned when Letifora was built. The monsters defend the area stubbornly. We let them live there because the Akronta enjoy hunting them. Tungdil surveyed the harvested fields, roads and streets running between the cities. There did not appear to be any villages to speak of, but a few extensive farmsteads here and there. Small forest areas ensured a green panorama. "Where is the Akronta army?" asked one of the guides. "I don't know. Perhaps they're taking the mountain route and looking out for more monsters."
In the far distance, Tungdil could make out a silvery shimmer. That must be the sea. Circa had told him about it, an endless expanse of water with storm winds and waves high enough to make ships and whole islands disappear without trace.
"Our first destination is Letifora," said the Ubari. "From there the road leads straight through monster territory toward the Black Abyss."
"Why not use the paths you showed me back there? If we march with all these troops, the monsters might be alerted to the fact the artifact is not working."
The Ubari shook his head and patted the neck of his mount.
"The paths are dangerous. You can easily get lost, worse than the roads we took. And then you won't ever find the way out. The Ubariu once lost a complete army. So did we. The ones who survived somehow were lucky enough to find their way back with tales of rocks that came alive, evil vapors, and the most ghastly creatures that lay in wait for them. That's why we took the other route. Nobody but the Akronta dare go that way." He grinned.
"The monsters whose land we'll go through are much too cowardly to stand up to us. Nobody challenges an army of 100,000.
He dismounted.
"We'll wait here."
He sent two of his men back to inform Flaga and to guide them through the labyrinth.
"Where is the hidden road to Girdlygard?"
Tungdil asked, sitting down on the ground, while the scouts started laying a fire. He could not take his eyes off the city. He had noticed high masts with ropes spanned between them, carrying cages above the streets. The wind, he fancied, was bringing him new sounds and smells.
"You'd have to go back half a star course toward the west, just short of the monster's land. The entrance is easy to miss in spite of the bastion we and the Ubariu have erected. We don't want it looking too obvious, otherwise there'd be even more of the beasts turning up."
Tungdil was as excited as a small child, looking forward to the orbits he would be spending here with Circa. Not for a moment did he regret having turned his back on Girdlygard. Forever, it seemed.
"What are those cages?" he asked.
The scout blew into the fire again to bring the flames to life. Blue and green flickered up.
"Must be the wood," he surmised, seeing the dwarf's surprise. "I've seen yellow and red fire too."
Then he nodded over at the masts.
"That's how we get around. We've got these platforms in Letifora, and the transport's really easy going in straight lines. Saves a lot of time you'd waste going on foot, especially when the roads are crowded. You can get about 50 humans in one of those cages, less if it's us, of course. And Akronta prefer to walk."
Tungdil had spotted a bridge of titanic proportions running directly to Letifora from the mountains in the southwest.
"That connects with the mines, does it?"
The scout grinned.
"Only a dwarf would ask about mines. No, it's a water channel supplying the city.
There are distribution points in the city itself, taking the water in pipes to the various districts.
And how?
The Ubari lifted a hand.
Tungdil, let me see to my mount. Then we can talk some more. But I'm sure Flager and Serka will want to explain the delights of Letaphora to you.
He stood up to see to the wants of his beefen. Tungdil went over to his pony, lifted off its saddle, and led it to where it could graze. Then he took out paper, inkwell, and a quill, and began to make a drawing of the strange town.
The Outer Lands, City of Letaphora, Early Autumn, 6241st Solar Cycle. Tungdil was only to have this one short fascinating insight into life in Letaphora for now. Flager took him and his friends into town to introduce him to the ruler, who watched over the fate of his subjects from his residence in the most impressive of the buildings. As the group rode along the broad street, the gates were opened for them promptly when the sentries recognized Flager's standard. The inhabitants bowed, clapped spontaneously, or called out. Not understanding the words, Tungdil nevertheless assumed they were being congratulated and welcomed. The exterior walls of the local houses were covered with a clay layer, bearing ornate decorations executed by skillful artisans. Some of the houses were colourfully painted, while others were duller in hue, but striking, because of the use of tiles and ceramic ware. There seemed to be a liking for rounded archways and window frames. Buildings here were on a par with the standards set by his own kin, but differed from the type of houses favoured by humans. Oval and round shapes were popular. Many took the form of globes set half in the earth, a style not seen in Girdlegard. Details were picked out in coloured glass. Mosaics showed ornamental shapes or hunting and battle scenes. On some facades, there were candid depictions of the physical act of union, such as would have made Girdlegarders blush.
"Very nice indeed," Rodario commented, trying to get a better view. "So you still have something to learn, Fabuloso?"
Eihart laughed. He pretended not to mind this civic lack of prudishness, but he avoided looking too closely. It was not fitting.
"Of course! There are always new ideas."
Rodario smiled in greeting at some of the women passing by, and when they inclined their heads in response, he had a generous view into their décolleté.
"It's even better to learn from a mistress of the art, of course."
He smiled at the warrior.
"You know what I mean, don't you? You favour a swift stroke, I believe." "Keep your smutty ideas well away from my relationship,"
Eihart warned him without a trace of humour.
"I won't have you dragging things down to your level."
His fists were clenched.
"We'll discuss it another time, then,"
Rodario conceded defeat, but winked at a passing maiden who immediately averted her eyes. They approached a square building that tapered off toward the top with wide staircases on each side. Above, the construction had a flattened oval shape, which supported four towers.
"I'm used to great buildings, scholar," said Eihart, "but this is more impressive than anything I've ever seen."
His eyes wandered over the stone walls.
"I can't decide whether this used to be a mountain, or whether they formed it out of enormous blocks of stone. There are no joins to be seen."
They rode into a hall, which was a good 100 paces square. Servants hurried over, humans and Ubariu, to take care of the animals, while an undergroundling in a light blue silken dress appeared and bowed before them. Her dark brown hair was long and wavy, and her skin nearly black. Around her waist she wore a decorative bejeweled chain, fashioned from some unfamiliar metal. Tungdil and Goda were astonished but tactful, while Eihart voiced his surprise without inhibition.
"By Vrakus, has she burned herself?"
he asked, with much sympathy and no volume control. Flager laughed outright and Circa grinned.
No, Boindil. She will have had black skin from birth. Our people come in all kinds of different colours, not like you.
He made a face.
What on earth for? So their enemies can't see them in the tunnels, perhaps?
I can't tell you what Ubar intended. It's just the way it is, Circa answered.
You are being rude,
Goda mouthed to her mentor.
Don't stare.
Jolly good thing they don't understand our language, said Rodario. Otherwise you'd have to be apologizing all the time. Why? Just because I'm curious?
Ironheart shouldered his crow's beak.
It's difficult to imagine a dwarf wearing that pale blue. Or a deep red.
That's not what I meant when I said different colours.
Circa looked to Tungdil for help.
So, what colours did you mean? Wait and see.
Flager put an end to the conversation.
They're expecting us.
He exchanged a few words with the undergroundling, then they followed her. The party strode through rectangular galleries 5 paces high, climbed steps to a floor where the corridors were semicircular, then moved on to the next level, where the walls and ceilings of the walkways had a lozenge shape. Tungdil had to ask Circa about this.
The building depicts our belief system, which encompasses underworlds and overworlds. Each of these worlds has a different symbol. We climb up through each of these worlds, up to where the ruler of the city is. He was chosen by Ubar and is his representative.
So, is he a god as well?
He is the voice and the hand of Ubar. To ignore or challenge what he says would invite punishment from the hand of the god.
The undergroundling in the blue silk approached a gate that was 5 paces by 3, fashioned out of polished silver and guarded by 2 heavily armed Akronta. Tungdil, Rodario and Ironheart immediately thought of Jerun. Round the gate was a garland of chiselled runes and paintings of warriors and fabulous beasts. Tungdil assumed they must be the gods of the upper and lower worlds. Above them all, larger than life, was the picture of a being that he knew well. Broad jaws with rows of protruding needle-sharp incisors and an oversized bony head a bit like a human skull, and covered with a thin layer of unhealthy-looking skin with veins painted in yellow. Instead of a nose, there were 3 large holes.
Jerun! By the gods! Stammered Tungdil quietly.
Lot Ionan took the diamond out of the pouch on his belt, but even he could not take his eyes off the portrait.
What sort of creature did Andakai have at her side? We're there now, said Flager, taking a deep breath. Are you ready to meet the ruler of Letifora?
He pointed to the picture.
To your eyes, he may look like a monster, but don't forget he is the image of our god Ubar. Show respect.
He nodded to the undergroundling, and she gave a signal to the Akronta guards. The sentries sprang to life, took hold of the gate's iron handles placed 2 paces above floor level, and flung wide the double doors. Light streamed through the tall room. Countless windows, each as high and wide as one of the tall armed guards, permitted the ruler a view over the eastern part of Letifora in the early morning sunshine. The chamber walls bore enchanting painted friezes, with inlays of gold, silver, and other precious metals adding opulence. On the regal stool on the throne dais, there sat the mightiest Akront they had ever seen. Now they knew why the corridors all needed such high ceilings. The monarch must have been a good 4 paces tall. He wore neither armor nor helmet, but instead a flowing garment of white fabric embroidered in gold and black. The similarity to the details of his portrait in the entrance hall was striking. According to Gerdlegard's standards, a long way from a beauty. His large violet-coloured eyes appraised the visitors. With a deafening crack, the wings on his back unfolded. blocking out some of the light. It had been with that very noise that Jeroen had so terrified the orcs and all other creatures of Teon. The undergroundling in blue went to stand at the Akronth's side. She addressed Flager.
He says you are welcome here in Letophora, and he is delighted our mission has had a positive outcome.
Circa translated for Tungdil and his friends.
So she can understand him?
Iarhart stroked his black beard, puzzled.
I thought it was supposed to be impossible.
She is his consort. She needs to be able to understand him,
Circa answered simply.
In each generation, there is one of us born able to understand an Akront, and she has been chosen to be his wife and to rule at his side.
Rodario bent over to the warrior.
How does it feel when you've just insulted the mightiest woman in the land? Master Foot in Mouth? I did not insult her, Big Mouth,
Iarhart insisted, quietly, but he was furious. Goda placed her hand restrainingly on his arm. This was not the moment for an argument. The Akront was speaking again, and, as his spouse transmitted his words, Circa translated for the others.
It seems the news of the army's destruction was false.
Who brought that news, Celestial Akront?
Asked Flager.
It was a stranger, a woman who knew magic. She came to Letophora some time ago and told us how badly things were going in Girdlegard. She said she had managed to get here with the last of her strength. With the diamond.
She showed it to you, Celestial Akront?
She did. I gave her an escort to go to the Black Abyss.
But that cannot be,
exclaimed Lotionen in agitation, opening his palm and displaying the true diamond.
You have been tricked by a forgery. We have the real stone.
Rodario took a deep breath.
I have absolutely no idea what is happening, but it's not going to be good.
Tungdil stepped forward.
Did she give her name? Celestial Akront?
The Akront's uncanny eyes focused on the dwarf, and the creature spoke once more, its voice transfixing Tungdil. The import was transmitted to the consort and then translated by Circa.
Yes. She called herself Narmora. Narmora the Forgotten.
Chapter 20. The Outer Lands, east of the city of Letophora, 1 mile from the Black Abyss. Early autumn, 6241st solar cycle. The noise created by 20,000 swift-moving beefens and the jangling of weapons and armor was enough to send the monsters crawling deeper into their hiding places in the ruins of the old houses. No one dared emerge. The Akront of Letophora was not relying purely on the combined strength of Ubariu and undergroundlings. With the army, he sent war machines as complex as any Fergus had devised. 4 armored vehicles, each 40 paces long, 10 wide and 10 high, rolled at the head of the march and 4 at its rear. Iron plating across wooden frames made them look like hulls of overturned ships. Catapults in the bellies of the machines were ready to launch flurries of spears and arrows through the slits. Placed high up, these afforded a superior range of around 300 paces and could fire in 360 degrees and so cover any part of the battlefield. These colossi were driven by a simple but efficient system of wind sails. On the upper side, there were large rotating towers and sails to catch the wind's power, which was transmitted by shafts to the driving axle, much as wind power drives a miller's wheel. The machines labored along on a series of small rollers and could match the speed of a furious dwarf. Not to be sneezed at.
Impressive, aren't they? Rodario said to Tungdil.
He too had changed mounts and was now riding a beefen. They were so much quicker than other animals.
Did you see how quickly the vehicles changed direction?
The rollers work individually, so they can turn on the spot and even go sideways. At the roadside, Tungdil noted the corpses of creatures shot in encounters with the first wave of troops. The beasts had learned not to attempt the same thing again.
With just one of those vehicles, the orcs could have been cleared out of Girdlegard ages ago.
Rodario seemed to be studying the wagon, but he was preoccupied with what the Akront had told them.
It can't be Namora. We saw what was left of her. The Star of Judgment burned away all that was elfish in her. She can't possibly have survived.
Magic and love are powerful forces, and not always benign,
Lotionen chimed in, riding at Tungdil's side.
Don't forget it was Fergus who located the magic wellspring. In his madness, he might have constructed a machine out of her remains, similar to those he made out of the Unslayable's beasts.
Rodario gave himself a shake.
Namora turning up again? A dead thing with a mechanical heart made of iron springs and cogs and only moving because of magic in her veins? Fergus could never have done that to her. He loved her too much for that.
He loved her so much that he could do it. He did not want to be without her, contradicted Tungdil. Let's hope we can stop her before she destroys the artifact.
What terrible vengeance to wreak on Girdlegard. What would be the motive?
Asked the Magus.
But it's exactly what he swore in Parista that he would do, Tungdil recalled,
thinking back to when he had broken the news to Fergus of the deaths of his daughter and his life partner. The hatred in the Magister's eyes had been greater than any smouldering in a thirdling.
The Judgment Star cost her all she held dear, her children, her whole life.
Rodario looked at where the ground fell away and no grass grew, only sand and dead earth, as if life itself were afraid to approach what lay below. The armored vehicles at the head of the column broke formation now, slowing down and fanning out so that the ones from the rear could join them. Circa had been listening in silence. Now she heard the fanfare.
We'll soon be at the Black Abyss. We need to take the diamond up to the front.
The Beefens altered their pace to powerful leaps. Strangely enough, the unpleasant swaying motion was reduced at these high speeds. A wide, bare indentation appeared in the landscape with the chasm at its center. The Black Abyss was a good half mile in length and 100 paces wide, and looked like a slash cut in the body of the earth, its edges dark and smooth. Steep paths led up on either side.
Like a gangrenous wound, commented Ironheart,
spitting in disgust.
The beasts are the pus.
Flager gestured south to a strange device at the entrance.
That's the artifact.
He gave a sigh of relief.
It seems to be intact. I had feared the worst.
Tungdil forced himself to say nothing. He must not kill their optimism. Namora had been a powerful Maga. Who knew what a demi-half was capable of?
Have those exits guarded, he said to the Ubariu. To be on the safe side. We don't want to be ambushed while we're activating the diamond.
He turned to Lotionen.
Are you prepared, honored Magus?
He studied the vast crater.
If it is possible to be prepared for what awaits here?
Ironheart looked around him.
What's happened to the advance party? We've seen no trace of them. The escort will have gone down the ravine, but I can't think why. Perhaps a battle. Or maybe Namora had a trick in store and she's woken the beasts of the abyss.
The army split into two sections, with 10,000 Ubariu and undergroundlings positioned in front of the exits from the Black Abyss, a living barrier to whatever might come storming out. They kept 100-pace safety margin from the precipice edges of the dread ravine. The armored vehicles moved into position sideways on behind the troops. Inside, the tank's adjustments were made. The windsail wheels were running, but as yet not engaged. Flager had explained that the sails were not just a driving mechanism, but also produced energy for additional catapults. If the wagons were stationary, it was possible to activate mechanical slings. These could fire off constantly, using wind power, and the crew only had to ensure the aim was correctly adjusted. They used their own supply of munitions, or could scoop stones up from the ground below the vehicle through small hatches. The vehicles were ready. In the meantime, Serka, Tungdil and friends had reached the artifact. It consisted of several upright linked metal rings in roughly the form of a globe, with a diameter approaching 20 paces. Symbols, runes and chiseled marks and patterns adorned the rings. A series of reinforcing rods radiated out to the circumference from a central decorated hub.
"The diamond needs to go in there, I assume," said Lotionen, getting down.
Iarhart shaded his eyes against the sun and looked up.
"How do we get up? I can't see a ladder." "That's why we need a rune master," Flager bowed to Lotionen. "Or our magus, of course. You must have a flying spell."
"No, why would I?"
"Then you'll have to climb."
"Wouldn't it be better if you carried him on your back into the center?" Rodario ventured.
"You look stronger."
Flager shook his head.
"I can't touch the artifact. Only a rune master or a magus who is pure in spirit. Anyone else will be pulverized if they try."
At that moment a horn sounded. It was a leaden tone issuing from the depths of the ravine, a dark, ear-splitting screech full of hatred and elation. It summoned its subjects with the promise of freedom, murder, and destruction. The friends could do nothing until the last echoes died away.
"It's been heard," Serka mouthed fearfully. "We..."
Out of the ravine surged an angry chorus from thousands of throats.
"Here they come!"
Flager leaped onto his beefen.
"I must join my warriors. They must see I am not deserting them."
He drew his sword and nodded to Lotionen.
"Revered sir, it was an honor to meet you."
Flager raced off. His commands could soon be heard in the distance. The first rows of soldiers knelt down holding long iron spears to impale the first wave of beasts. In the ranks behind, the archers made ready their bows, while others held their huge shields to form a protective cover for their heads. The wagons opened up their shooting flaps. Lotionen approached the artifact, which was sending out enough energy to make the individual white hairs of his beard and on his head bristle and stand out. His steps slowed the nearer he got to it. He glanced behind to where the others were waiting and following his every move.
"I..."
He was trying to say something, but he felt a blow in his chest. He stumbled backwards and fell in the dust, a black Alf arrow in his breast. It had struck him right in the heart. A shadow fell over him, and a man leaped over his body, grabbing the bag at his belt that held the precious stone. Warm blood spread as Lotionen's damaged heart continued to pump. Then it stopped. With a groan, Lotionen closed his eyes.
"Fergus?"
Rodario had recognized the man who had sprung from behind one of the iron rings.
"We are in the Outer Lands. Here the dead return."
The Magister snatched the diamond from the dying magus and walked slowly backwards.
"I tricked even you, incredible Rodario."
He smiled in satisfaction. When Tungdil took a step forward, Fergus raised his arm.
"Stay where you are, or the arrow will get you."
He indicated the other end of the artifact where a woman was standing with a bow spanned ready.
"We shall see the evil released from the Black Abyss. With my assistance, it will march into the heart of Gerdlegard."
He put the diamond in his mouth and swallowed it. Iarhart raised his weapon slowly.
"What a stupid idea," he growled.
Now I'm really going to hurt him.
You can't prevent it. Fergus looked over at the ravine.
That is the revenge I wanted for Gerdlegard. The land will be submerged in waves of the beasts and will be annihilated. A fitting punishment for its arrogance and for having followed the dwarves and their false beliefs.
He stared at Tungdil.
The Eoil were never a danger. It was you misbegotten dwarves interfering that robbed me of my family.
That isn't Namora, murmured Ireheart. She would be doing magic.
Rodario said nothing, but knew he was right. It could be the woman he had seen on the boat in Mifidania. He was cross with himself for not having thought about her again. Now that the name of Namora had been mentioned, he was clear who she had resembled. That was why Fergus would have selected her as his ally. Perhaps in his twisted mind, he actually thought she was his beloved spouse come back to life.
All that, the destruction of a whole land, all for the sake of vengeance? Do you think that's what Namora would have wanted? She fought with us against the danger.
She didn't want to die, Fergus cut in. No, you will all pay by mourning your loved ones, as I have been mourning mine, for over 5 cycles now.
He shook his fist and moved away.
In Gerdlegard, there will be not a single soul who does not experience the pain I feel.
And then?
Rodario carried on the train of thought.
Then Gerdlegard is finished.
Why not? For all I care, the lands can go hang, he shrugged. None of the worlds are anything without her. She gave me children, and she saved my life.
You deceived me, Fergus.
Rodario went up to him. The archer let her arrow loose, and it hit Rodario in the right thigh. He fell next to Lot Ionan. The archerwoman notched a second arrow with lightning swift and practice moves.
I told you, stay there and watch.
Fergus stared at his former friend without a trace of remorse.
It's your own fault you were hit.
From out of the ravine the roar continued to belch. An ugly hail fell on the allies. The remains, severed limbs and heads and chopped flesh of the advance party, whom Fergus and his assistant had lured to their deaths. The dull thuds were sickening as the gruesome missiles fell on upturned shields and armor plating. The spraying blood and appalling smell did not fail in the intended effect. Circa became resolute. She had lost friends and relations, and was determined to avenge their deaths.
You have made terrible mistakes,
Rodario groaned, clasping his hand over the arrow wound.
Don't make it worse. No one will forgive me what I have done.
There's no making it worse,
Fergus cut in.
I built the machines to hound the dwarves. I didn't take a lot of persuading when Bandilor suggested it. And I was happy enough to side with the Unslayable. I knew exactly what I was doing, and I planned it all in detail. Now I am at my goal. Why would I stop now?
We found your tunnel. Evil won't be getting through there anymore, Tungdil told him,
as he gave Goda a signal. Ireheart understood as well.
However did you manage to make those bastard hybrids out of machines and monsters?
There's always room for coincidence in my plans. He smiled.
When we were prospecting for iron ore on the lake bed, we noticed the rocks were quite different. I thought of the source in Parista and started to suspect a connection. And it occurred to me we had found the metal that conducts magic.
He looked over to the abyss. The shower of body parts did not seem to be drying up.
I wondered if the machines could use it. Namora had told me about the magic dormant in Alphar. When the Unslayable left his bastards with me, I just tried it out.
Pride shone in his eyes.
The 2 Thirdlings smelted me the special metal, and then I created the new machines. Nobody before me had ever thought of combining magic, iron, and living bodies.
You turned them
into well-nigh undefeatable monsters. That was my plan, Tungdil.
He folded his hands and was deathly calm.
I just wanted a distraction. While you were chasing the machines, nobody worried about me. My tunnel could have been finished without anyone noticing. But the Black Abyss serves my purposes better.
Fergus turned to the mighty incision in the earth and nodded.
Hard to credit, isn't it? I was playing you this farce all along, ever since Rodario turned up on the island.
Fergus turned to the actor.
My simulated suicide made it all perfect. You believe me, and you told me all your secrets. Because of you, my revenge will be sweeter than I could ever have imagined. Yes, if we did but know certain things in advance. Like the existence of the Black Abyss.
The thudding had stopped, and the horn sounded once more. The Black Abyss launched its horrors onto the defenders. Tungdil was too far away to see exactly, but the monsters surging out of the chasm seemed far worse than anything known previously in Girdlegard. Some had four arms and claws, others had two long necks and heads, like snakes. He noted a big fat creature as tall as a tree, with a red body shimmering moistly like raw meat, and half a dozen tentacles waving in the air, grabbing at anything in range. When it caught its prey, it simply squashed it up against its own flesh until clouds of steam rose. The victims were dissolved in acid and ingested directly via countless mouths. Similar ghastly beings came running and riding out of the ravine, large and small, unspeakably ugly and horrific to see. Winged monsters as tall as a house crawled up the ravine sides and threw themselves off to take advantage of updrafts and prevailing winds. They sailed over the heads of the Ubariu and with their long claws ripped open the scalps of the defending warriors. The catapults had opened fire now and were keeping up an answering barrage on the attackers. Flying beasts attacked the armored wagons, landing on them or climbing on top to destroy the wind sails or to strip off the iron plates to get inside. The allied army had to support the vehicles under attack. Suddenly the shrillest of screams issued from the depths of the chasm. It was louder than any other noise. The voice was so loud that it cracked the rocks at the side of the chasm. Friend and foe alike stopped in their tracks in utter horror, and the monsters ceased their onslaught. They were terrified of their own kind.
"Ubar, protect us," whispered Circa,
flinching and stepping back involuntarily.
"A Cordrian! Only the cry of a Cordrian can split rocks," it says in the books. "Nothing can hold it back if it escapes."
Fergus scuffed.
"And there isn't anyone to hold it back, Circa."
He pointed to Lot Ionan.
"Your last hope lies there. The old man has failed."
The hand of the Magus moved. Assumed dead, he still managed to direct a dark green beam at Fergus. It swept the technical genius off his feet and sent him flying up toward the hub until suspended exactly above it. Then the wizard broke off the ray, and Fergus sank down. At the last moment, he put out a hand to grab one of the reinforcements. The woman took a shot at Lot Ionan, but the arrow never made it. Magic forced it to hang in the air. Lot Ionan had been prepared for the attack.
"Great! The stone is up there now! It's just got to get into the setting!"
Iarhart ran to confront the archer woman, Goda at his heels.
"I'll take her, Scholar. You find a way to get Lot Ionan up to the diamond."
Tungdil and Circa helped the Magus to his feet. Lot Ionan drew the arrow out of his flesh and discarded it.
"It's not so easy to kill a Magus," he said with a peculiar smile. "Evil will not prevail."
He grasped the iron rings to start the climb. A bolt of lightning struck from the center of the artifact, sending the wizard sailing through the air to land 4 paces away. He lay groaning as smoke poured out of his body. "Lot Ionan!" Tungdil ran to his side. The wizard's hand was badly burned, and the skin was flaking off onto the ground. Blood seeped out of the blackened flesh. His eyes had turned back in his head, and he was convulsing. Circa stared.
"It's because his soul is not true,"
she realized with horror. She watched the battle rage.
What now?
Their army was holding their ground on nearly all sides, but a few of the creatures had broken through the defense line, and it was these misbegotten beings that were now heading toward the artifact. They were well aware what had held them prisoner for so long in their black ravine. They were desperate to destroy it.
"I don't know,"
Tungdil replied quietly. Raising Bloodthirster, he mounted his beefen and rode to confront the monsters.
"I'll keep them busy. Then we'll have to see. Look after the Magus."
Ironheart had reached the archer and smashed her bow just as she was notching her next arrow. It fell harmlessly to the ground, and she leaped back in fury, drawing her sword. His eyes flashed.
"So, you cowardly murderess, let us see what battle skills you have now that I've broken your favorite toy."
He dealt her a blow with his crow's beak. She sidestepped deftly and launched a kick, but he was able to ward it off with the handle of his axe. He drove the jagged point, where the spike had broken off, deep into her flank, tearing a gaping wound. She fell back, gasping.
"You ain't seen nothing yet, you crafty bitch,"
he crowed, and, whirling his axe, was about to strike when she threw her sword. It missed him, and he heard Goda cry out. Up until recently, there would have been nothing that could have distracted him in combat, but his concern for Goda did so now. He turned. The archer's sword was stuck deep in Goda's arm, and the impact had forced her backwards, right up against the ring of the artifact.
"Fracas, no!"
yelled Boindil, thinking of what Flager had said. In his mind's eye, he saw Goda transformed to ashes, torn by lightning bolts, consumed by flames. But nothing happened. Before he could realize how surprised he was, he felt a sharp pain in his side. It had a hellish kick. Turning, he faced the flying fist of the archer woman.
"Not so fast,"
he exclaimed, and hit at her hand with the flat of his battle axe. There was a loud crack on contact, and the finger bones crunched. Without waiting to see what she was doing, he dealt her an uppercut with the jagged edge, shattering her chin. She fell to the ground, but still slashed out with her dagger. Ironheart sprang to one side, and the glistening knife tip missed him.
"My turn,"
he laughed, lifting his weapon high over his head to slam it down with all his strength.
"What does a skull do when it bursts?"
The woman had no answer. Under the blow from his axe, her head demonstrated the solution to his riddle. From far above, Fergus shouted. He had found his footing on one of the crossbars and sat there, condemned to watch and wait, which was what he had demanded the others should do.
"We'll deal with you in a minute,"
Ironheart called up. He raced to Goda's side.
"Are you all right?"
"Yes," she said.
"I was careful, master."
Laying his hand on the sword handle, he pulled it out of her arm. Goda gave a quiet moan. He showed her the sword.
"Never throw your weapon unless you have a second one," he reminded her. "She still had her little toothpick."
Goda noticed the blood trickling out of his side.
"I can see."
"That? Only a scratch."
He inspected her back for any scorch marks on the armor. Nothing. A slight giddiness forced him to plant his feet firmly on the ground.
"Goda! Ironheart!" called Circa. "Come over here. The Magus has something to say."
It was only now that the two dwarves saw Lot Ionan stretched out on the ground next to Rodario.
Oh, no. Did he fall?
Asked Boindil somberly.
Now we'll need a catapult to get him up there.
They ran to the Magus. His breath was short, and he was obviously in great pain. Sweat glistened on his forehead.
I didn't fall. The artifact rejected me, he explained.
Iarhart looked up at Fergus.
Fine artifact this one is. Why doesn't it grill him instead of you?
Lot Ionan turned his pale blue gaze on Goda.
You must go and complete the task.
Me?
The dwarf maiden raised her night star as if in excuse. I'm a warrior and...
The rune master knew, and I saw it with my own eyes, too,
he interrupted, speaking hoarsely.
Goda, you bear within you the gift to use magic, and unlike mine, your soul will be pure and innocent.
Innocent? Rodario scoffed. It's a good thing the artifact does not have ears, after what I heard in Pendleburg.
Goda blushed. Iarhart looked sternly at Rodario.
We were doing wrestling drills, actor. She is still untouched.
Lot Ionan gazed steadily into Goda's brown eyes.
I don't know how. Perhaps from the magic source, or perhaps you've had it from birth.
Is that what you and the rune master were talking about at the campfire that night?
Rodario remembered the evening he had shared the strange spice with Flager and seen the two men talking.
Yes. I did not want to tell Goda until we had completed our mission. You might have been my Famula.
He shut his eyes, and his teeth were chattering.
Climb up, Goda!
His words could hardly be heard now.
Kill Fergus! Put the diamond in the setting and save Gurtlegard!
And my homeland too, added Circa.
On the left, more and more beasts were breaking through, heading for the artifact. Tungdil rode back and forth, felling one creature after another, but there were far too many. 3 dozen were coming their way. Circa pillowed Lot Ionan's head on her mantle. Then she took her combat stick and nodded to Iarhart.
I think we've got work to do.
Rodario broke the arrow off close to the entry wound and got to his feet.
Well, you'll be needing me as well. I can't miss a third opportunity to be a hero.
Iarhart gave Goda a tender kiss.
Hurry, but not too fast. Leave a few for me and my crow's beak!
He turned to face the foe. Again the world seemed to waver in front of his eyes, and he needed to blink before his sight cleared.
Irrepressible,
was all Goda said. She went to the nearest ring and sought a hold for her fingers as she started to climb.
Just you try, shouted Fergus. I'll kill you!
Circa twirled her weapon and looked at Iarhart. Can I ask a favor?
Sure.
Tell me the joke about the orc and the dwarf.
Now?
Might be our last chance, Circa grinned. The first monster was 10 paces away, swinging a huge sword.
Hurry! Well, one orbit. A dwarf meets an orc at the stone gateway.
Iarhart raised his crow's beak.
The orc saw him and said, Little man, can you tell me where?
Circa's adversary arrived and grabbed her attention with a hefty swipe.
Later,
she called to Iarhart, as she put her heart and soul into the fight. Tungdil spurred his beefen across the battlefield, striking at the monster's heads with Bloodthirster. Each strike took a life. The refashioned elfish blade raged amongst the enemy throng. It seemed as if the sword were helping of its own accord, directing its own attack, and seeking out the most vulnerable places to strike. The weapon was uncanny, but fascinating. But whatever efforts the Ubariu and the undergroundlings made, more and more creatures broke through the defences as soldiers were lost. The winged monsters could not be stopped. They seemed immune against attack by arrow or crossbow bolt, and had overturned 2 of the armoured wagons. falling in swarms on the others. Swift as the wind, they tore off the heavy plating to slaughter the crew inside. The remaining vehicles gave the infantry some cover and kept up a spear attack, but they too were damaged.
Curses!
Tungdil halted his beefen to study the artifact. He saw Fergus at the top, and that a small figure was making its way up on the outside ring.
Gota?
The beefen cowered and emitted a furious roar. All at once, it was dark round Tungdil, and a foul-smelling wind touched him. Claws slashed to the right and the left, lodging in the flesh of his steed, then up he soared. The ground fell back, and he was hovering over the battlefield, witnessing the butchery on both sides of the chasm. It was a miniaturized version of what he had been experiencing himself.
What?
Tungdil turned to see the hideous face of one of the winged monsters, its muzzle agape. His first thought was to plunge Bloodthirster between the teeth of the beast to kill it. But it would have meant his own death. From 100 paces up in the air, a fall was certain death. Instead, he leaped off his injured steed to land on a claw of the flying beast, who dropped the beefen and uttered a fearful cry. The animal tumbled to earth, smashing four Ubario beneath itself as it fell into their own ranks.
You won't shake me off, snarled Tungdil,
stabbing the monster in the belly, making a gash half a pace long, out of which a stinking liquid gushed to drench him. Screeching, the dying beast tried to land, coming down over the line of undergroundlings and skimming over the spears of the Black Abyss army, before it came to earth with widespread wings, blundering through the ranks and killing or maiming maybe 50. Vrakas protected Tungdil. Apart from a few scratches and a shallow gouge on his right calf from a spear tip, there was nothing. So he struggled out from under the wing and found himself standing right in the middle of the opposing army. He had not been noticed. The foremost ranks of the Ubario and undergroundlings were an arrow's flight away, and the entrance to the chasm 50 paces from him.
Well, Vrakas, whatever your plan is, he said, looking round, I'm very keen to know how it all ends.
Again he heard the sound of the Cordrian. Stone cracked, and a landslide of rubble buried several beasts. Immediately there was stillness, and the warriors' eyes all turned to the entrance to the ravine. A pale claw, as wide as three fortress gates, shot up out of the blackness of the abyss and took hold of the outer edge of the ravine, trying for a hold. Cracks formed, and rock crumbled, under the pressure and weight of the creature that was still down there in the dark, attempting to free itself. Its claw fastened into the rock again, the long nails taking hold. The most dwarven of Tungdil's virtues came to the fore. When all about him was hopelessness, he kept his head and drew on the qualities of steadfast stubbornness and pig-headedness, or whatever other folk thought of when they spoke of the dwarves. He climbed up the corpse of the winged beast so that both friend and foe should see he was there. He took his bugle from his belt, placed it to his lips, and replied to the call of the Cordrian, sounding the battle signal into the horrified silence.
I shall not allow you out of your prison, he bellowed down into the chasm.
He raised Bloodthirster, drenched as it was with the black lifeblood of all the creatures he had vanquished.
The weapon I snatched from evil shall be the one to stop you, whatever you are. Fire fights fire.
He stormed straight through the ranks of the beasts and hacked to pieces every assailant that dared to cross his path. It was as if their armor was but butter and their bodies but straw. Behind him, he heard Flager's voice. Then the Ubario yelled, and the undergroundlings hallooed, joining their efforts with his own. Hope began to blossom. Flager saw Tungdil suddenly appear between the enemy ranks and the cadaver of the monster. He had sounded his horn as fearlessly as if standing in safety behind the walls of Letophora. His words resounded clearly, echoing over the death-filled field. Then he sprang forward.
Uba! You have sent us a true hero, whose courage surpasses even that of an Acront, he avowed, lifting his sword. Let us follow him!
He sent his rallying cry to right and to left.
We shall be the first to defeat a Cordrian! For Uba!
Stepping forward, his weapon grasped in both hands, he cut the beast that reared up before him into two halves, slicing from skull to groin. He was covered in its dark blood, and the smell of it spurred him on. His warriors joined their voices to his own and sallied forth. Turning their enormous shields, they charged 10 paces deep into enemy lines. There they halted. The first Ubariu formed a protective metal wall, cutting off the antagonists now behind them from the main army of monsters. Following in the wake of the Ubariu, the undergroundlings bombarded this isolated section, felling monsters so swiftly with their combat batons that the creatures could not coordinate any defense. Meanwhile, pressure was increasing at the shield barrier, where the Black Abyss hordes were menacing the Ubariu.
Again!
Yelled Flager, calling for the lance with his banner affixed. They repeated the maneuver. Turn shields aside, let some of the assailants through, hem them in, and butcher them.
Take care!
Called Flager to the front line overlooking the field, holding his banner aloft to ensure the enemy knew what name death bore. At that moment, he felt a searing pain in his side. Suddenly there was an arrow sticking out between his ribs, making breathing a torture. Yet Flager did not surrender to the pain. His fingers contracted around the shaft of his lance, and he used it to support himself. Show no weakness. The battle must first be won.
And change! Now!
Those fighting at the front withdrew, and were neatly replaced by a second line of fresh warriors, so that the onslaught kept up its momentum. Their enemy floundered when faced with well-drilled strategy like this. The monsters were exhausting themselves in their relentless attack. Losses, however, were many. More than once, Flager saw a good friend fall, heard a death cry, and chimed with it in his soul. On the outside, no weakness could be seen, even though he would have wished his fallen warriors out from underneath the carcasses of slaughtered monsters. They deserved a better resting place. Several of them he had known for countless star cycles. He had trained them himself. To watch them die like this hurt as badly as the arrow in his side. Morning would have to wait, as always in battle. Flager saw that one of the armored vehicles was set sideways on to provide cover for their advance. Flurries of arrows and spears were whizzing out over the heads of their own troops. The archers knew their stuff. 5 whole rows of the enemy were felled by these missiles, and a second salvo mowed a wide path through the heaving, screaming throng.
"Onwards and forwards!"
commanded Flager, his spear aloft and the pennant cracking in the breeze, signalling the major assault. Goda climbed up. Now she had reached a crossbar and slid along on it toward Fergus. Beneath her, Circa and Ironheart were thumping the life out of the beasts. Rodario had a short bow and a quiver taken from one of the creatures, and was loosing arrows at the foe. No matter if your aim was not very good, in this crush you would always hit a target. Ironheart gave full vent to his battle rage. He used the madness coursing through his veins to make him insuperable in combat. The crow's beak whirred without rest, denting helmets, shattering bones, slicing through armor, and hurling the victims a good 2 paces through the air. Circa, for her part, was fighting like the water element, slipping into gaps and using the barb on her slim weapon to strike and the hook to fend off blows, to wrench swords out of assailants' hands or to thrust into unprotected flesh. She never stayed long in one position, but moved with flowing grace. Goda had nearly reached Fergus. He was watching her.
"What do you think you were doing?"